Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe. It's so good to see you this evening. Woo! Thank you for coming out. So typically I have a very long quote or poem to start with, but tonight I only have to say a quote from Voltaire. Doubt is an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is a ridiculous one. So whether or not he actually said that, the internet said he did, so good enough. Here with me to discuss the psychology of uncertainty, the fabulous professors and psychologists from the University of Texas at Austin, two guys on your head, Dr. Bob Duke and Art Markman, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks so much. Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the psychology of uncertainty. What are we talking about when we're talking about uncertainty in the brain?
Well, I'm not sure how to start.
We didn't plan it.
How long are you working on that?
Thinking about that all day.
But first of all, I have to say thank you all so much for coming out. This is really a remarkable crowd for a Tuesday evening. I think we should probably start with the idea that many of us enjoy the idea of a predictable future. We'd like to know what tomorrow's going to be like and what our workspace is going to be like and what's going to happen with our family. And also far into the future, we'd like to think that, you know, we will have sufficient funds to retire, and we might even have, you know, thought about where we're going to retire and do all these kinds of plans. And those plans are comforting in many ways. But the unfortunate thing about planning is that life happens. And a lot of the things that we plan don't actually come to pass because there are things about our lives that we don't anticipate. And some of those things are very personal and close to us, and maybe no one else would know about that. And there are other things that are broader in scope and affect more people than just ourselves. And I think one of these is probably useful to talk about tonight is how all of us as individuals have different levels of tolerance and acceptance and enthusiasm even about not knowing exactly what's about to happen.
And if we think about just the concept of uncertainty for a second, we have to recognize that there are two different ways that uncertainty comes into play. So the first is just statistical. So we are, despite the fact that very few of us may have a lot of expertise in statistics ourselves, actually our brains are calculating statistics all the time. We are making predictions about how often particular events are going to happen in our environment. And those predictions actually, those statistics that we're keeping track of allow us to make predictions about what's likely to happen. Now, some events are highly predictable. So you flip the light switch and you're pretty darn sure the lights are going to go on. And every once in a while they don't, and that's surprising. And now you have to go figure out what the problem was. But that's one of those things that always seems to happen. And then, you know, there are things that are semi-predictable from that statistical standpoint. So, you know, if you have a teenager, sometimes they're in a good mood, right? And sometimes they're not. And you can sort, and there may be certain things you can do. So if you hear at 4:30 in the afternoon, if you hear clunk, dun, 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 you can predict with some certainty that your teenager's not in a good mood that day. So there's certain kinds of predictions we make statistically. And then on top of that, there are also explanations we give to the world that help us to make predictions. So we have theories about the way that the world works. And some of those theories are not scientific theories. They're just theories we have about the interactions we have with particular colleagues or the way things tend to go at work. And then we have scientific theories or more scientific ones that may predict, you know, when there's going to be an eclipse or something like that. And even in those cases, our theories are only so good, meaning that there's always a few causal elements that are missing from those theories. And the more causal elements that are missing, the more that we have trouble predicting some of the things that are going to happen. And as a result, in those situations, there's also some uncertainty because we don't have a complete theory. And so it's just important up front to kind of lay out the fact that we have this very kind of statistical predictive system that is not always able to predict with complete certainty. And then we also have our explanations that are more or less good in different situations.
Yeah, and I think it's probably important at early on in this discussion to talk about the idea of the purpose of brains. Before there were brains, there were many organisms that got along just fine. And in fact,
many of them are deans.
Yeah.
Kidding.
That is worth the cross stitch on a pillow. But if you think about like a total biomass of the Earth, most of the biomass of the Earth does not have a brain. So you have to think, why would evolution create something that expends so much biological energy? What's the point of all of that? And actually, the only reason for brains is to predict what's about to happen. Because any individual organism is better able to navigate the vicissitudes of life if they're able to predict a little bit about what's going to happen, right? So if you're chasing prey and you know the prey probably is going to go toward that little hole that it's going toward and you know to turn left, you're probably better able to catch the prey. If you're a potential prey and someone else is chasing you and you know that that organism probably can't fit under that little space that you're going to go into, you go into that space because that's a prediction you can make. If you're looking for a mate and you make certain predictions about what might be attractive to that mate and what might be entice that mate to spend a little time with you, we could talk about this more later. You're better able to navigate the world. But you know, there's a trade-off, right? Because predictions are often wrong. And as Art was saying just a minute ago, I mean, it's good to be able to anticipate what's about to happen, but it's not good to anticipate too much, because much of what we experience is not what we would have predicted. It's not what our evolutionarily ultimately advantageous brains would predict is about to happen. So now this brings up another dimension, and that is, now what, right? Now I thought this, and we had this, so how am I going to respond to that? And different individuals, different members of our species have different reactions to that.
And there's actually a kind of evolutionary escalation in deception and difficulty in being able to predict behavior. Because one of the things we know, for people who do evolutionary biology, one of the things that they do is that they ask what sorts of strategies that animals might pursue are evolutionarily stable strategies. So you could ask yourself, for example, as a philosophical question, why doesn't everybody just tell the truth? Darn it, it would be so much easier in life if everyone told the truth. And the answer is because that's not an evolutionarily stable strategy. Why? Because if everyone told the truth, if you were the one person who lied, you'd have a big advantage over everybody else. And so what happens is we develop strategies that have a certain degree of unpredictability to them, because to the extent that our behavior is completely predictable, then someone can always exploit that. Someone always can take advantage of that. And so part of what makes it so difficult to be human is that we are living at the leading edge of a consistent arms race that creates behaviors that are unpredictable enough that they allowed us to survive by creating a fairly stable environment. And so that's the mess we find ourselves in, okay? And so part of what we need to discuss is really two things. One is, how do we deal with that uncertainty? And then the other is, how do we avoid too much certainty?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we'll get to in a little while is the differences among individuals among us who have different responses to uncertainty. And, you know, I think all of us are looking for in life an optimal place between uncertainty and predictability. You know, if things are too predictable, that's just boring, right? And if things are too unpredictable, that seems chaotic and stressful. So somewhere in the middle of that is our sweet spot of unpredictability. And what's interesting, you know, I don't know how many, couple hundred people are in this room, whatever, everybody's got a little different place about that, right? There are some of us in here thinking, I don't need unpredictability. I want to know what's going to happen tomorrow. I want to be able to plan what's going to happen. I want to know how this meeting is going to go. And other of us think, well, I'm just going to walk in and wing it, you know, and thinking this is going to be great. Yeah, why is he pointing to me? But I think that kind of that difference among individuals is really an interesting part of what we need to talk about tonight, is that everybody has different levels of tolerance for ambiguity. Right. If everything was ambiguous, we wouldn't survive. I mean, there would just be too much uncertainty. We would make literally catastrophic mistakes in our lives. But there is a level of predictability and a level of uncertainty that somewhere in between those two extremes is a sweet spot that each of us finds for himself or herself.
So let's begin honing in on this a little bit. Okay. First of all, personality psychologists will tell us that there are five big personality characteristics, so they cleverly call those the big five. And one of those is a characteristic called openness to experience, which is in some ways to, you know, how do you deal with novelty? And of course, something that's novel has got a lot of unpredictability to it. When you go to a new restaurant, you're not entirely sure what you're going to get. When you engage in a new experience, you know, things could go wrong. When you do the same thing again, it's highly predictable. So overall, there are individual differences in how open people are to experiences. Some people love to wing it. Some people need to have everything in their life scripted out in advance. And then there's, you know, a range in between. Now that's at the high level. As you begin to dig down into this more, though, you realize it's actually a little bit more complicated than that, because there are different domains of uncertainty. And the people who study this most actually tend to study it under the heading of risk, because to engage in a behavior where the outcome is uncertain means taking a risk. If you're not taking a risk if you engage in an action and know exactly what's going to happen. And so there's a definitely an interplay between risk and uncertainty. Now, when people study risk, the best scales for measuring individual differences in risk recognize that there are domains of risk and people differ across those domains. So, for example, there's physical risk. Are you willing to hurl yourself down a mountain on skis, Rebecca?
They don't know this.
They don't know this, I know. We'll tell that offline later. Stay tuned. Are you willing to go bungee jumping? Are you willing to hurl yourself outside of an airplane with naught between you and the ground but a little piece of cloth? So that's physical risk. There's financial risk. Are you willing to gamble your money? Are you willing to take a risky investment in the stock market? There's social risk. Are you willing to get up on stage in front of a group of people and risk embarrassing yourself in front of a lot of people? So all of these different areas create risk. There's intellectual risk. Are you willing to throw an idea out there and risk having people think that you're kind of silly or stupid? So all of those things are domains of risk. And just because you are risky in one domain doesn't mean that you're risky in all of them. So personally, I'm willing to take social risks. I'm willing to take intellectual risks. But I'm really not particularly willing to take financial risks. And I'm really not willing to take physical risks, okay? And so there's, you know, we deal with these kinds of uncertainty in very different ways.
And I'm sitting up here with 11 broken bones in my torso from a skiing accident. So that's why
Thankfully, she's okay.
Bodily
that's
risk,
right.
But I'm okay.
Which is why
we're doing this show, actually.
Yeah, and Art make sure his zip line is only 2 feet off the ground. So it's fun, but it's not the same.
I've worked my way up to 2 feet. It was just a painted stripe on the ground for a long time.
My level of uncertainty is typically like when I ever get to talk, when you two, you know, when I'm on a show with
is
you.
Is there
guys.
Uncertainty
I have no
in
idea.
That?
I have no idea.
I think if you just assume never, you're going to be fine.
But, you know, I mean, what I want to know is, you know, how do we face uncertainty? Like, there is so much uncertainty and knowing that things really aren't certain, and yeah. then a lot of uncertainty in the world, like, how do we get up every day? How do we face it?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting the way freshmen come to college. I was in a meeting today, actually, about talking about sort of helping freshmen make the transition from high school into college. And what I find is that many freshmen, either because of the discussion they have with their parents or whatever has led them to think this way, is that they're going to have everything planned out. You know, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to take these courses, and I'm going to get this degree, and then I'm going to go to graduate school here, and I'm going to do these things. And again, you know, the thing that we want to help them understand is that that's a very nice idea, but that's probably not going to happen the way you anticipate. And what's interesting to me is that for many students, learning that it's probably not going to go the way you plan is actually a comfort. Because if you have a very rigid plan that you think this has got to happen or my life is over, you know, and you're 17, right? And that's where you're thinking, that's a tremendously stressful place to be. And to hear from people who are older, I mean, not as old as we are, as Art and me are, but I mean, as older than an undergraduate student, to hear from their upper class peers and those kinds of upperclassmen peers to say, you know what, I thought I was going to be doing this and now I'm doing that and I'm really happy. That's a tremendous learning experience for a young person, because I think, you know, I think people, especially in high achievement oriented families, do program people that certain things have to happen in your life or you're doomed. You know, you've got to go to Yale or some Ivy, or what the hell are you going to do? You know, and I think a lot of writers have written about this. Frank Bruni, writes for the New York Times, wrote an interesting book about just this idea that if you don't get into the right college, just forget it. You know, he's not suggesting that's the case, but he's saying that many people think that, when in fact, that's just a crazy way to think. I mean, there are many people who follow lots of different life paths that are fulfilling and rewarding and interesting. And the idea when you're a young person that there's a limited, narrow window of what you have to squeeze yourself through or else you're screwed is just a very unhappy place.
And it's really important to prepare for the uncertain life that you're going to lead. Because one of the things, so here's an interesting problem. One of the things that happens in uncertain environments is that you get stressed about it. So, because it's stressful not to know exactly what's going to happen. The problem with stress, though, from a cognitive standpoint, is that it narrows your focus of attention and it decreases your working memory capacity. So working memory, the amount of stuff you can hold in mind at any given moment. More stressed you are, the narrower your focus, the less working memory capacity you have, which means you're less able to improvise on the spot. And so part of what you need, and you need those improvisation abilities in order to be able to navigate the uncertainty. So here's kind of the problem. So initially what happens to people is in uncertain situations, they fall back on whatever stereotypical habit they've got in that situation. What we need to teach people is to face as many uncertain situations as possible, to recognize that the downside risk actually, generally speaking, isn't so bad, which removes some of the stress, increases that working memory capacity, broadens the focus of attention, and actually makes you better able to navigate stressful situations. So for example, right, public speaking is potentially stressful for some people. Right? I mean, it's stressful enough that, as I've said on some of the shows that we've done, we actually use the threat of public speaking as a stress manipulation in experiments. We tell undergrads, look, you've got 5 minutes to prepare this big speech you're going to give in front of 4 experts. And people panic in that situation. Right? Now, the problem is, of course,
We do apologize to them later. After
we do. You know, yeah.
Before they sue you. So,
yeah, well, true. But the thing is, right, what happens over time, if you get up in front of people often enough, is that a lot of that stress associated with public speaking actually begins to fade away because you've done it often enough to realize that even if you completely bomb in front of a bunch of people, you know, it's only one viral YouTube video. So how bad could it be?
I feel so much calmer now. You know, I have one anecdote that sort of illustrates the point that Art's making. You know, when I was a graduate student in college, one of the things that I did to make extra money is I taught piano to very young children. And those of you in the room who've taken piano lessons know that there is no better way to instill anxiety in young children than piano recitals. And I had made up my mind, I'm not going to do that. Because the problem with these young people's piano recitals, and actually many of my undergraduate graduate students' recitals in the Butler School, are a lack of realism about what's about to happen. You know, students, very fine musicians, who have never played through their piece flawlessly on their best day, you know, when they're the most rested and the least stressed, think, well, now it's my recital, now it's all gonna come together. No, it's not. So when I would teach very young children and it was time for them to play in front of other people for the first time, I would say to a child, for example, you know, you're playing one of my favorite pieces. I love this piece. And you play it so beautifully. And I bet today, when you play in front of everybody, you're probably only going to make like 6 mistakes. And you're probably going to have to stop once and start over again. And of course, the kid's looking at me like, what? You know? And then the kid goes out and plays. And you know what I'm going to say, or I wouldn't be telling the story. Guess what? I only made 4 mistakes and I didn't have to stop once. Yay! You know? Now, the thing is, what we're talking about is creating an expectation that's more in line with anticipated reality, right? Because we all over-anticipate our ability to plan and control the future. And the future is mostly out of our control. I mean, we can do lots of things that make it more likely that things will happen. But one of the things that Art and Rebecca and I were talking about when we were back in the back room back there drinking before we came out here, is that, well, that's what we do.
Who can't lie.
is that, you know, the idea of certainty seems like a comfort in the abstract, but it's actually a detriment in reality.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's one thing that I really want to talk about is kind of these moments when interruption make a mark on our memory. You know, and like interruption is so important and kind of unexpected events. Like there's this wonderful quote I love, never let a crisis go to waste, you know, which is like the value of things happening that you didn't expect and what you can actually do with those.
I love that quote, but I think Donald Rumsfeld said that, which doesn't make me happy at all. But
our great philosopher, Donald Rumsfeld.
So, but. So it's funny though, like when major.
See, no one expected that.
Nobody.
I like
our
it.
Main element is fear and surprise.
He said much more that Zizek quotes all the time.
Right. So, but one of the things about crises and major disruptions is people will talk about life events and say it gave me such perspective on life. What, you know, and what do we mean by that? And I think there are two elements to this that are important. One, of course, is that there are times when we are miscalibrated about how much worse things could be, right? So there are kids who grow up believing that the worst thing that could happen to them in their lives is that they don't get into Harvard, okay? Largely because, you know, scurvy isn't an option. And so, you know, so sometimes having a major life event recalibrates you a little bit. So, you know, smacking into a tree backwards, I imagine, makes you feel better about, you know, someone who might be annoying you in at work or something. Not that you have anyone who annoys you at work, but because this is on tape. But But, you know, so there's perspective that way in recalibration. But then there's perspective in another way, which is that when you are mired in the details of your life, right, you see the details of your life and you think, I got to do the next thing, and then I got to do the next thing, and then I got to do the next thing. And you, and as the saying goes, you lose the forest for the trees, right? And at some point, perspective also gives you that opportunity to pop back up and say, is this really what I want to be doing? Is this really the direction I planned on? And so there are also opportunities where disruption allows you to take that step back from your life for a moment, look at it in its more abstract, broad perspective, and ask the question, is all of this stuff that I've been doing on a daily basis that's very predictable and very comfortable actually leading me to the place I wanted to get to? Or in fact, do I need to reorient some of the things I'm doing, accept a little bit more uncertainty into my life in order to achieve a goal, a more abstract goal that's more important to me?
And there's another thing about, you know, how we perceive what we're paying attention to every day also, you know. So, you know, we perceive that we're reading a book, for example, like Marcel Proust talks about in Unreading. We're reading a book and we think that we're taking in that knowledge, but we're actually taking in all of the knowledge around us, you know, where we're reading it and what we're smelling and, you know, what the temperature is at the time. So, like, how do those... How does interruption and uncertainty play a part in how we perceive what's around us?
You know, I think one of the things that Art mentioned briefly earlier was the individual differences among all of us in terms of what we tolerate in terms of interruptions, disruptions, uncertainty, that kind of thing. And, you know, what's always interesting to me is how much of that has to do with the actual physiology of the brain. I mean, I think Art rightly thinks that I have an overly mechanistic view of the way brains work, and I think that we underestimate how much the chemistry that's operating in our brain affects how much we react to things that are unanticipated, especially when they're not pleasant, and how we find comfort or not in predictability and those kinds of things. And I think, you know, generally we imagine that people's personalities are sort of this thing that we choose. You know, you could choose to be more open. Well, yes, that's probably true for everybody, but some people find that tremendously easier than other people because of the physiology of their brains. And I think, you know, one of the things that to me is always something on the front of my thinking when I'm talking to students and other people is being empathetic and sympathetic of other human beings who are not like us. Right, because we tend to think, well, just get it together,
suck it up, man,
just suck it up, right? And in fact, for some people, that's a very challenging task. For other people, like sand off a beach. So the idea that we don't accept the fact that there are individual differences that are not a matter of volition, that are not a matter of just not having the right mindset, but there are actual physical features of our brains that make it harder or easier for us to do certain things. You know, I mean, if some guy who's 5'2 wants to play in the NBA, and we tell that guy, if you just try hard enough, you know, that no, you won't, you know. And I think the idea that we think mental things, you know, things that are hidden inside the recesses of our skulls are things that we just change by will. And that's not what happens.
Yeah. Which is not to say we can't make changes in our behavior, but we have to recognize that some people are going to find those changes more effortful than others, right? Some people actually find it quite easy to, you know, they've been doing one thing for a long time and now they're just going to do another thing. And you know, there are people I know who smoke for 25 years and then one day they wake up and say, I'm not a smoker anymore, and they stop. And then there are other people who can't do that, right? And it's not that one person was better than another in some you know, ethical sense. It's, you know, the brain is wired in different ways. And so we can't expect that everyone is going to deal with exactly the same circumstance in exactly the same way. And by the way, there's good reason for that. Again, when we think about evolutionarily stable strategies, one of the things we have to recognize is that almost every setting that the brain has, in the normal range at least, is a setting that has some value in particular circumstances. So being extraordinarily open to new experiences is pretty awesome in Austin, Texas in 2017, but, you know, maybe not so much in a war zone or you know, in the wilds of the jungle, you know, where there might actually be a tiger lurking behind the trees, right, where you might want to be a little bit more cautious. So having a range of people in the group so that someone might say, you might not want to step out there just now. Those teeth look very sharp. You know, that it's a benefit to have that range of different reactions to the potentially risky things that are out there in the environment. And part of what that means, and one of the reasons that this matters is, think about the people that you hang out with. People often choose to affiliate with people who are like them in some way, right? So they say opposites attract, but actually, you know, all things considered, we tend to hang out with people who are actually quite like us in many ways. Well, if you're very risk-taking in a particular domain, and all you ever do is hang out with other people who are also really risk-taking, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. It is actually useful to have at least one person in the group who says, is this really a good idea? Maybe even two people.
Yeah, and one with the keys.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Yeah. And the skis.
And the skis.
I'm never going to live this time, but at least I'm alive. So
that's right.
Well, now for the most uncertain part of the evening, when we take your questions. So just raise your hand, because I get to talk to these guys all the time, but I'm sure that you have questions out there.
I'm still recovering from the loss of certainty about 9:30 in the evening on November 8th.
7:30.
And I'm just wondering, from an external point of view, the impact of unreliable polls, fake news, and alternative facts, how that affects the world we live in and our grasp on reality and uncertainty.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's an interesting thing about human beings, and I think we talked about this in Friday's show, I think, that we are built to be credulous of our peers, right? We're believing people. Because as Art was saying on the show, I think it's impossible for us to actually know from, as we say in academe, from primary sources what the facts are, right? I mean, there are a lot of things that I think I know that I have no direct experience about. I read about it, someone told me about it. So there's an advantage to that as a species, as a group. You know, that everybody doesn't have to know firsthand about everything. You know, if we're out in the plains somewhere and, you know, my tribe mate Grog goes out and falls off a cliff, you know, and somebody says, you know, Grog, don't go over there because that's where Grog fell off the cliff. I don't need to go say, well, what cliff? And then go fall off the cliff, right? I can, there's an advantage to that. But there's a disease in the system, and it's what Art was alluding to earlier about, you know, the one liar in the group has the best advantage, right? Because you can say things, and if everybody's counting on everybody to tell the truth, well, then you can say all kinds of things, and people will believe you, even when it's patently untrue. But I think this isn't a new phenomenon, and Art was making this point too. I'm making all your points. So you know, there have always been people who have taken advantage of the fact that people are credulous. It goes all the way from used car salesman, if anybody's a used car salesman, I apologize, or who says, you know, I got to go back and check with the manager, and then he goes back and, you know, gets a drink of water and then comes back and says, you know, okay, I can give you $100 off that car, whatever it is, or the undercoating, you know, whatever crap they're trying to sell you. But I mean that kind of thing, people tend to believe that. I mean, the reason people are taken advantage of so often, and this gets back to the uncertainty thing, if I live a life where I doubt everything, I am in a tremendously stressful place. And I think all people who have been burned, just use the phrase, a lot, find themselves in a very stressful place. I mean, my mother, who died a couple of years ago at 89, happy person all of her life, she was incredibly credulous. And she was taken advantage of all the time. And I used to be, you know, bothered by that in the sense that, God, those people are taking advantage of my sweet mama and she's so, you know, trusting and all that kind of thing. But you know what? She slept really well at night. I'm serious, right? Where other people would think, well, I don't know, was he trying to rip me off? Is that, you really believe that? Now, the thing is, you might say, well, I don't want to be taken advantage of, damn it, and I'm going to make, but actually there's a cost to that, right? So the, it isn't cost-free to be skeptical. I mean, it does cost you a little bit. And all the things that, all the data that people have about what people who are religious believers think and other people who have some kind of creed that they feel like this is an unfailing aspect of the world, there are advantages to that. I mean, that's not just naive people, right? There are reasons that that kind of thinking evolved. But again, there's a trade-off in that because you're susceptible to being taken advantage of, which is why Art says when you have groups of people together that vary in those characteristics, well, you've got somebody who can say, you know, we really shouldn't fall for that.
I want to pick up on a slightly different part of what you asked in your question, which is you said unreliable polls. And I actually want to point out that it's actually that the phrase unreliable polls in the context of the last election says something very interesting about our ability to deal with uncertainty. Because if you look at things like 538.com, which is a mathematical model that they put across the variety of polls that are calculated, there are actually two things that emerge from that. The first is that actually the average polling for the number of votes that each candidate was going to get was just about right. Okay, let us not forget that the candidate who did not win the election did get more votes. Okay, and that's number one. The other is that the statistical models that they used to predict the outcome of the Electoral College vote still gave about 20% a chance of a Trump victory. Now, when we see 20%, we have a hard time saying if we run this five times, one time Trump is going to win, because that's just hard psychologically to do. So what we do instead is say 80-20, it's going to go this way. And we inflate the certainty associated with the uncertain event. When in fact, what we got was a statistically rare event. But one in five may, you know, doesn't seem like a lot, but honestly, would you get on an airplane if I told you there was a 1 in 5 chance it wasn't going to make it to its destination, right? So in fact, the polls were not as unreliable statistically as we've now remember them. But that really has to do with a difficulty that we have internalizing intuitions about statistics and not the polls themselves.
And just a brief addendum to that. Our implicit statistical reasoning is pretty good. Our explicit statistical reasoning is terrible. Right. I mean, somebody had written a letter. I don't know what publication they sent this to after the election. Trump won the election, said you just learned what a 20% chance means. Right. Yeah. Is that it's not zero. Right. I mean, 20% is 20%. OK. Anyway.
Another question?
Yes. At what time in our lives should we stop worrying about uncertainty and just live life as it comes?
Eight.
Eight.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing. I think, again, even when, for those of you who have had little babies in our house, you know that by months of age, you start to see tendencies about how much I'm able to deal with stuff that I don't think is supposed to happen, right? And everyone has different ways of responding to that. And one of the things that I think differentiates people who are more accepting of kind of uncertain things that are inevitable and people who aren't has to do with the speed with which they react. You know, everybody, whoever came up with the idea count to 10, genius. Because what your first thought is, and now I've got a response ready to go. And even that 10-second pause changes the way you view the situation. A day really changes it. A week, it's not even in the same universe again. And it's interesting to me because we tend to think it's an inherent way of processing something, but the speed has everything to do with it. I mean, all of us now in the age of email who have been able to keep our jobs know that when you write the email response, you don't send it then, right? You put it in your draft box and you wait till the next morning and then you read it and enjoy how pithy and on point that is and you don't send it, right? Because the idea is if I responded as my guts are telling me to respond, I can now see that nothing good can come of this,
yeah,
right?
And I would say also that when it comes to dealing with the uncertainties in life, I think that as we get older, one of the things that we have to become more adept at is bouncing back and forth between the forest and the trees. Because there are times where we want to pursue the strategy that Bob's mom pursued, which is live the life that you're comfortable with and just be happy. Right. And so putting yourself into situations that you find really stressful is not always a good idea. Right. I mean, maybe, you know, sometimes it's just nice to be able to fall asleep and not be worried about stuff. So the reason you want to bounce back and forth between the kind of the high level perspective on where you're going in life and the low level perspective of how I choose to live my day to day life is because you want to ask yourself, you know, and something I've talked about before is to take advantage of this remarkable ability to project yourself to the end of your life and ask yourself, are there things I haven't done yet that I would regret not having done? And it's when you do that and think, you know what, I've never done this particular thing, and I really feel like I would regret never having done it, that you have to then say, well, what's held me back from doing that? And if what's held you back is something that in the moment would make you feel uncomfortable because of its uncertainty, then that's a good candidate for putting yourself into a situation that is uncomfortable. And I don't think there's a particular age at which that, like, now is the time to do that. My general belief is if you've ever got 5 spare moments, because we live this, you know, kind of hectic life, playing that game a little bit and saying, is there something I haven't done that I really ought to do, is actually a valuable thing, because you might find a few minutes to start pursuing that new thing. And even though it may feel uncomfortable in the moment, it gradually gets more comfortable and it helps you to check off yet another thing from that bucket list.
Yeah. But then there's that question, like, when do you listen to your intuition and when don't you? When is your intuition really valuable? When should you kind of check it?
If there's a really large object coming towards you at a really high speed, you know, listen to your intuition. But in most experience we find ourselves in, you know, we have time, you know. And I think one of the things that happens often, unfortunately, for many very young children, because all parents who have, you know, the best of intentions, we want to protect our children from every hurt and discomfort. And, you know, my wife always says, I would prefer our daughter to live in our house until she's 45 years old, and then we'll let her go try stuff on her own. But fortunately, we didn't do that, and she went out and had a life. But I think, you know, what happens if as a parent, as a caregiver, you think, I want to solve problems really fast. You know, problem, let's fix it. You know, or let's keep it from happening. That what an individual learns, what a child learns from that is, you know, I don't have to tolerate stuff for very long because stuff gets fixed right away. Well, no, it doesn't. And even though we may have a very attentive, some might even say hovering parent that fixes things right away, learning that, you know what, if I kind of am upset for a little while and then my upsetment starts to calm down and then somebody comes and comforts me because I've calmed down a little bit, I learn a different thing as an individual, right? Because what makes people unhappy is the dissonance between what I think is supposed to happen, damn it, and what's happening right now. And all the people who, the phrase that people use, for the word they use for this is resilient, all the people who have a measure of resilience and flexibility have that because it's not just what they want to have happen, it's how fast they want it to happen, right? And if you think about all the things that we do, I mean, when I have some bad thing happen to me, I'm upset. But one of the things that I've learned to do is not react in my upsetment because I realize my judgment is impaired, right? And if I'm responding then, I'm going to respond in ways that are suboptimal for me because once I gather my wits about me and time has passed, first of all, my emotion level has gone down, my stressors have gone down, and now my working memory capacity has gone back to what it normally is, and I can make a better decision.
And one of the things that is implicit in everything Bob is saying is that in the moment, particularly when you are energized, right, I've talked a little bit about the fact that we have these two motivational systems, right? We have what we sometimes call the go system, which is the one that drives you to act. And then we have a little bit of brain material above the eyes that tries to stop you from acting, called the stop system. And the thing about the stop system is it can be overcome by too much energy in the go system. It can also be overcome by stress. Which is why Lloyd Bridges in Airplane keeps smoking and drinking and all that stuff, because he's stressed. And it can also be overcome by drugs and alcohol, which is why you may have encountered people that you know who've done things that they didn't intend to do because they'd had too much to drink. I know you. Nobody in this room has ever done that, but you may have heard of it, okay? Now, you might have. It's many movies, in fact. The Hangover, I think. But I think that one of the reasons that this is important is because in the moment when you're very stressed and energized, the go system tends to take over in that specific moment. And so that's why you may be prone to an intuitive reaction that is actually going to get you in trouble, because sometimes the best thing to do in a situation is actually not to do anything. And the human body, when the go system gets revved up, wants to do something. And so that's where the value of the productive pause matters so much, because it helps to calm some of that energy in that go system and keep you from doing the thing that you're going to regret later. And here's the problem. In the moment, when you're totally energized to do something, your motivational system clears the deck for action. And it does that in two ways. First, it makes you notice all of the things in the environment that are going to help you to achieve that goal. But second, and this is very subtle, it decreases your sense of how important the downside is. So, for example, research we did in my lab shows that habitual smokers are less concerned about lung cancer when they really need a cigarette than when they don't. Okay? And in the moment, those teenagers are less concerned with the consequences of getting caught at whatever they're doing than they would be in other circumstances, right? Which means that it's very important, if you're going to engage in some kind of risky behavior, to make an assessment of the downside risk outside of the context of how appealing it would be to try to do this thing in the moment.
And this just emphasizes the machines in our heads, right? I mean, it's not a matter of will. It's not a matter of, you know, whatever. There are understandable explanations for why evolution would have led to this way of acting and behaving, or not right. acting and not behaving.
Because there were no wedding chapels in Vegas.
There were no wedding chapels in Vegas. Right. There were no fast food restaurants on every corner. There were no things that would conspire to exploit all of the things that were very advantageous in early hominids that have now become disadvantageous in a contemporary society. And I think, you know, what that leads me to think about a lot is being forgiving of ourselves a little bit and forgiving of other people who seem insane. Because I realize, you know, and I think we all can realize that much of what's driving our behavior, much of what's leading us to do things or not do other things that maybe we should do, is not just poor character. You know, that may be how we characterize it, how we describe it. But a lot of it has to do with there's a way that this was at one time advantageous, except now in this situation and this circumstance, it's not advantageous. In fact, it's nasty and we don't like it and we don't want to have that.
So we have time for about two more questions.
Yes. So I've been hearing a lot more lately about a basic income, and it occurs to me in the context of this that it gets rid of a lot of financial uncertainty for a lot of people. What are your thoughts on the trade-offs, good and bad, that might happen because of that if we had that policy?
You know, I mean, let's be perfectly honest. Extreme poverty really sucks for people. I mean, you know, as we would like everyone to be able to eat regularly and to be able to put a roof over their heads. That roof doesn't necessarily need to be in a 5,600 square foot house, but it you know, a roof is good, clothing is good. And I think that you know, it's for people, it's very hard for those of us who live privileged lives, as Bob often says, to imagine what it's like not to know when you're going to eat again. And from a societal standpoint, there are ethical reasons and also financial reasons. It's just cheaper to have people who are regularly fed and clothed and sheltered, because they have a much better chance of then, even if they're not currently working, you know, if you have a stable address, it's one of the best predictors. So community psychology says if you have a permanent address, that helps you to get a job, right? So I think in a variety of ways, taking care of the most basic needs that people have without forcing them to go through a bunch of humiliating hoops, which might lead them not to want to do that, is not just humane, it's also extraordinarily effective. And so, you know, I think that as a society, the fact that we have the extraordinary wealth that we have now — this is opinion, not psychological fact, but I'll just come out and say it — the fact that we have such extraordinary wealth and yet have people who are lacking shelter, lacking food, lacking basic needs is egregious.
Yeah. And I think, yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's get our pink hats on. Let's go. I also say, add one thing to what Art is saying. You know, the things that we attribute to our own character and our own right mind are almost always in ways that make us feel good about ourselves, right? And if I'm convinced that the reason I'm a professor in a major university and have the income that I have and the job that I have is because, damn it, I earned it, you know, and not forget the idea that, you know, I was very careful in choosing my parents.
And the country you were born.
Right, and the country I was born in, and, you know, all those kinds of things. It does create a different attitude about what other people are capable of given other opportunities. And I think, you know, the things that we're talking about, uncertainty and those kinds of things, my life is unpredictable to the extent that I choose, you know, for the most part. I mean, there are some things that you know, you just can't anticipate health issues and that kind of thing. But I mean, day to day, I pretty much know what tomorrow is going to be like and what the next day is going to be like and what the next day is going to be like. That is a healthy human life, right? That's a key to being, having a sense of what we call well-being, right? And I think the question becomes, do you think for people who don't have that, is that because they just made bad choices or because they just didn't have opportunities to make the same choices that we did? And that's a really, an important question to ask, because I think all of us who are privileged enough to be in this room, right? I mean, we have the wherewithal to go out on a Tuesday night and hang out and buy a drink and hang out with people that we like and think are interesting. That's a huge privilege, right? And I think, when you imagine the mechanical part of how our brains work that I keep pushing on, and you start to apply that to why we're here and somebody else is laying on a piece of cardboard on Fifth Street, you have a different perspective about the way the world works. And I think this whole question came about, having a living wage. What's interesting to us, and we've talked about this on a particular show, when you look at sense of well-being and happiness, after your basic needs are met, there's virtually no correlation between income and happiness, but only after your basic needs are met, right? And so the question we have to ask ourselves as a society, as a culture, do we want to say everybody gets to start there, no matter what, and then what they do after that is their own thing? How do we get off on all things?
I don't know. We did a show on values, though. We should go back on that. But let's take one more question before we end. Go ahead.
How much of an impact does uncertainty have in school, jobs, and the work we create?
Well, I think it's the management of uncertainty that is one of the most important things, right? I mean, I think as Bob was saying earlier, one of the most important things that anyone needs to learn in life is that no matter how well you plan and no matter how well you try to understand the situation that you're in, something is going to happen that was unexpected. And the most successful people in life do two things extraordinarily well. They adapt to circumstances that were unexpected, and they learn from the mistakes that they make in the situations that were unexpected that allow them to deal with those better. Now, the reason that this is important in part is because I think our education system does not do a good job of helping people to learn how to deal with uncertainty. After all, we spend the first probably 16 years of our education answering questions that were asked by someone who already knows the answer to those questions.
Which is weird.
Which is really weird, because most of what you're forced to do for the rest of your life is to answer questions that nobody knows the answer to yet. And if we never practice that, how can we then expect people to be good at that later? And so I think we need to, and the thing is, the stakes get ever higher. The fact is that no matter what even the most dire helicopter parent might say, a bad grade in second grade has never kept anybody out of the school of their choice. Okay? And it's not, that unsatisfactory in second grade did not ruin someone's life. So it's a great time to fail utterly by trying something that didn't work out. It's a bad time in your first job after college to then totally, have a problem tank, right? That's a bad time to do it, because the consequences are just much more serious. So we need to do it when the safety net is there.
Is there anything about the disparity between the way college professors' lives are and the way our students' lives are? I mean, I think I speak for both Art and me that we've written grants that didn't get funded, and we've written papers who, because of the cretins on the editorial board, didn't get accepted.
Man, reviewer two.
It's always reviewer two. I know. And you know what? Those events are invisible. Now, when you take freshman chemistry and you make a C, that C will always be there. Now, what the hell, right? I mean, and as my junior high principal used to tell me, Bob, this will be on your permanent record.
And look where you ended up.
I know. Screw them. But I think one of the things that's interesting about that is that we built into, I mean, the very system that we're teaching in, of forgiveness of less than stellar performance, because we recognize everything can't be stellar. You know, and I now teach a class in the med school, and I work with med students who their undergraduate career is, if I don't make an A in this class, I mean, I might as well just end it, because it's nothing's, you know, my life is over. That's nuts, right? But when you create a sense of competitiveness that you need to do that in order to enjoy any happiness in life, you ignore the fact that outside of the realm of an educational system, that just never happens. I mean, Art and I have the great privilege of failing all the time. And I want to say, precisely because we get to fail a lot, we figure out a lot of really hard questions that you couldn't figure out without all the mistake making that we encounter.
Okay, so here's the last question of the evening.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So there is no Nobel Prize in psychology. It is where Nobel laureates go to die, and as you say. But if there was a Nobel Prize in psychology, what could psychology teach us? What would cognitive psychology win a Nobel Prize for today that we really need to know the answer to?
Well, occasionally they give the Nobel Prize in psychology to either people in physiology or in economics. So a couple of psychologists managed to slip through.
I didn't say that psychologists don't get Nobel Prize. There is not a Nobel Prize in psychology.
Well, okay. No, I mean, I think that one of the things that, I mean, we've learned a lot, actually. I mean, one of the things that, I'm going to expand the question and say one of my great frustrations as a psychologist is that psychology is the one science you are guaranteed to need for the rest of your life, right? Because you are likely to, A, have a mind that you need to use, and B, bump into other people whose minds are somewhat inscrutable to you. And it's one of the few sciences that you generally don't get much of in school, K-12. You might get AP psychology if you're lucky, and then a few people take it in college. So part of my frustration is actually not just that there are grand findings that we might honor with a huge prize, but more that there's an enormous accumulation of knowledge that we have as a field that would help people to deal with their lives better. So knowing what the big five personality characteristics are, which will then help you to notice why people are different than you. Understanding that you have a go system and a stop system. And so if you're trying to make New Year's resolutions, don't say, I'm going to stop smoking this year. Talk about what you're going to do instead, because the system can't learn not to do things, right? Simple things like this that can transform people's lives, and yet nobody knows them. So forget the Nobel Prize. Let's just start teaching psychology in first grade and thereafter.
Right, there it is.
I got nothing to add.
I know. There are actually some books on this. One is Smart Thinking, one is Smart Change, and one is Brain Briefs, which both of you wrote. So please go check out the great books and subscribe to the podcast of Two Guys in Your Head. Thank you so much, Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke, for coming out tonight. Thank you all for coming.
Rebecca McEnroy.
And have a beautiful evening. Thank you so much.
I know I'm stepping on Rebecca's exit here, but I have to say one thing before we go. You know, we've been doing this now for almost 4 years, I think, right? We're going on our fourth year of this. And this is all has come about because of that person right there who's a genius, who saw diamonds in the rough.
But I
want to tell you one thing that's related to what we're talking about. You know, the three of us never get over the fact that all of you come to these things. We don't. And you know what? We appreciate you a lot, and that needs to be said publicly. We appreciate you a lot. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks for listening to the show and listening to the podcast. And have a great night. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.